Support for the Exchange Podcast comes from you, our sustaining members, and from New Hampshire School Administrators Association, representing school superintendents and administrators, championing the education of children in our state every day since 1941. In today's ever-changing world, public education matters, and so does its leaders. Online at nhsaa.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. A recent cover of Time magazine illustrated just how long the U.S. military has been involved in Afghanistan. It featured the portrait of a young American training to serve there who wasn't even born when the conflict began. Since 2001, through three presidential administrations and countless political promises that the end was in sight, U.S. involvement continues. The human and financial cost has been enormous, 157,000 people killed, most of them Afghans, but including 2,300 U.S. military members. The cost to U.S. taxpayers is nearly $1 trillion. Today in The Exchange, America's longest war, why we got into Afghanistan, why we are still there. Our guests for the hour include Jason Lyle. He teaches in the Departments of Government and Transnational Studies at Dartmouth. He directs the Political Violence Field Lab, work that frequently brings him to Afghanistan. Jason, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you for being here. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And also with us from D.C., Craig Whitlock, investigative reporter for The Washington Post. Craig's recent report, The Afghanistan Papers, is based on previously unpublished interviews with people directly involved in the war, revealing that despite public declarations of progress, officials believed otherwise. And Craig Whitlock, really a pleasure having you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And I want to let everyone know that we did have a combat veteran of the Afghanistan War scheduled to join us. She had to cancel at the very last minute this morning. So we're really hoping to hear from veterans of this war listening to us today. So share your stories. Share your comments, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Craig, I want to start with you. Just remind us why the U.S. got involved in Afghanistan. At the most basic level, people know it was in response to 9/11. But walk us through that decision-making, Craig, because there were several weeks of demands and threats before the actual war began.
That's right, and it's been 18 years, so it's starting to fade in memory. But the war began, as you said, as a direct response to the 9/11 attacks, and specifically to try and destroy al-Qaeda and capture or kill the leader, Osama bin Laden. At that time, they were being given sanctuary in Afghanistan by the Taliban government, so there were several weeks of demands by the Bush White House for the Taliban to hand over bin Laden. The Taliban refused, and that led to the war. That movement for the U.S. to send troops to Afghanistan, along with other countries, to work with Afghan allies to topple the Taliban and go after al-Qaeda.
And at the time, Craig, again, in this sort of 3 or 4 week period before the U.S. actually sent forces over to Afghanistan, how much discussion was there, either within the administration or in the broader public, that, you know, maybe we don't want to go full in? Maybe we should do something small and targeted, but not do a full-scale war?
Well, there was a lot of discussion about the nature of the military response. And at the time, the Defense Department, led by Donald Rumsfeld, as well as President Bush, they were very careful that they didn't want to get stuck in a big land war in Afghanistan like the Soviet Union had from the late 1970s to the late 1980s. The United States very much wanted to avoid getting stuck in a quagmire by sending a large military force to Afghanistan, which, of course, is a landlocked country halfway around the world. So at first, when the war began, there was a very, as the military puts it, there was a very light U.S. military footprint along with CIA officers and Afghan warlords who were paid a lot of money to fight alongside the United States. And there weren't many troops sent over it. Even in the first 6 months, it was only a few thousand troops. And most of those were special operations forces as well as CIA paramilitary forces. So it wasn't a a big, huge military force like the invasion of Iraq. It was a small number, but over time that eventually grew slowly but steadily.
Well, let's just remind folks, Craig, that it was a coalition, right? There were other NATO countries involved. What was their interest and who were some of the biggest partners there?
Well, you have to remember back then, this was a shocking attack on the United States, the 9/11 attack. People who remember that, even though it's been almost two decades, this was an enormous surprise. The scale of the devastation and death in New York and at the Pentagon and in Pennsylvania, where one of the airliners crashed. This was actually the one time that our NATO allies invoked Article 5, which was, an attack on a NATO member precipitates a response from NATO, from the treaty alliance, to step up and defend another NATO member country, the United States. So there were a number of ally countries like the UK, but also others, eventually even countries such as Australia sent forces to help the United States. But at first it was mostly the United States military and CIA, but there were other countries involved. And over time, they sent more forces and more aid to Afghanistan to help in the war there.
Well, and you talked about the original idea around a light footprint and using local warlords when the U.S. first went in there in October of 2011. So what was the original stated goal? I think this is important to remember, Craig. What was the original goal as stated by the Bush administration?
Right. And people understood this at the time. It was to respond to the 9/11 attacks. It was to destroy al-Qaeda and to topple the Taliban government in Afghanistan, because it had been sheltering bin Laden and al-Qaeda. So those were the two initial goals. The backdrop to it was to also make sure that Afghanistan could not be used as a base to launch future attacks on the United States. And that's the part of the goal that's taken longer to achieve.
I see.
It was pretty ironic. Within the first 6 months, the Taliban was toppled from power. Al-Qaeda was removed from Afghanistan. Its leadership was either killed, captured, or it fled Afghanistan. By early 2002, there were very, very few Al-Qaeda left in Afghanistan. The Taliban had fled or was toppled from power. So the two original objectives were achieved early on. And after that period, that's where things kind of started to get fuzzy as to how long the United States would be there and what exactly it was trying to achieve.
Wow. Okay. And that's where the work that you did recently, Craig, the Afghanistan Papers, kind of takes off exploring why America has been there for so long. By the way, if you want to look at the Afghanistan Papers, you can go to our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And again, if you have served in Afghanistan in the military or some other capacity, or if you have questions or comments about this, our email, exchange@nhpr.org, comment on Facebook, tweet us, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So Jason Lyle and Craig Whitlock, here is the giant question that the Afghanistan Papers attempts to answer, and that I think a lot of Americans want to know. Jason, I'll turn to you first. So why has the U.S. been there so long? I know this is a multifaceted answer, but I think that's the fundamental question that people are asking now, looking back and going, wow, it's been 18 years.
It's remarkable. And we only have an hour, right, to try
right,
and get this
exactly.
answer down. It's really part of the problem is you're fighting an entrenched insurgency, right, that has slowly over time gathered strength, coming in from Pakistan, gathering support of the population, and become entrenched with sanctuaries in Pakistan. This is very difficult already to begin as a challenge. Then it has mountainous terrain, poverty, all kinds of conditions, and political scientists think are, you know, conducive to insurgency. This is a difficult problem anyway. And then the United States makes one really big mistake early on. It invades Iraq. And so much of the attention, so much of the resources are shifted over to Iraq that Afghanistan sort of falls into the background. There isn't a clearly defined political goal. You don't have a whole lot of tools on the ground. And the Taliban begin to reconstitute themselves. And by the time the United States sort of turns its attention back to Afghanistan, it's really too late. So by 2009, 2010, the United States starts saying, wow, you know, Iraq is starting to stabilize. We're having a full-fledged insurgency in Afghanistan now. We better do something about it. But by that time, you know, the horse is outside the barn. And, you know, this insurgency is up and running. And so the United States has never had a lot of leverage militarily. This is a political problem that needs to be solved. And over time, the Taliban have been winning on the ground. And it's hard to resolve a political issue if the one side thinks it's winning and is willing to bear the cost of continuing to fighting because it thinks it's going to win.
Wow. So when you say insurgency, what do you mean, Jason? Insurgency meaning creating that region where terrorism could occur again, an insurgency against the established Afghan government, established small e, because I know there have been problems there, insurgency against American forces, or sort of insurgency, what is that exactly?
So insurgency is really just a style of warfare that involves hit-and-run attacks against government forces or against American forces. You want to destabilize the government, you kill mayors, you kill political leaders, you begin to distribute money around to bring supporters on side. It's very difficult for a conventional army like the U.S. military to deal with insurgents. They don't stand and fight necessarily, they hit and run. And really starting in 2006 is when we first saw the first uptick of the Taliban insurgency gaining strength in small pockets in the south and in the east. And every year they've progressively been pushing out. And for the first 3 or 4 years, they really did so unopposed from American forces. It was slowly sort of in the backdrop. We recognized the violence was increasing. But again, Iraq was the predominant foreign policy issue. And by the time we figured there was a full insurgency ongoing and the Afghan government was being destabilized, it was really too late.
So insurgency against something that represents stability.
Absolutely. And really to try and tear down or delegitimize the Afghan government.
Well, and Craig, you know, Jason raises one of the key points that comes up in the Afghanistan papers. A lot of people in this report that you did say only fight one war at a time. So talk about Iraq and how the decision to invade Iraq in 2003 kind of shifted the whole situation in Afghanistan, Craig.
Well, that's right. And not just the invasion of Iraq in the spring of 2003, but for at least a good year, if not 18 months prior to that, the Bush administration quickly shifted its focus to making preparations for the invasion of Iraq. So after the Taliban was toppled really in late 2001, December 2001, that's when the planning really started. And some of the same generals and military commanders were tasked to start thinking about how do we possibly invade Iraq if it were to come to that. So both the time and attention of the decision makers in the White House and at the Pentagon and other agencies shifted, but then also a lot of the resources of the government and the military went into this much bigger military operation in Iraq, and that definitely took away time and attention and resources from the war in Afghanistan. And at that point, in 2003, Afghanistan was a devastated country. There's no question. This country was one of the poorest in the world to begin with, but after decades of war, it was just a shambles. But, you know, in 2003, things were relatively peaceful. You could travel throughout the countryside. There were still remnants of the Taliban and other guerrilla forces, but it was pretty quiet in Afghanistan. And I think that led the United States to take its eye off the ball and think that Afghanistan wasn't going to be a problem anymore. Or if it was a problem, it was a manageable problem with only a few thousand soldiers. And that's when the U.S. really got distracted and went all in Iraq.
Wow, it's really interesting to hear you say, Craig, in 2003, Afghanistan was relatively quiet. I can't remember the last time somebody said that. Jason, when did you start traveling to Afghanistan to do some of the research that you do on political violence and how to mitigate it?
So my first trip was the summer of 2009, and I was based at Camp Julian, which is a NATO facility base just south of Kabul. And I was there for an initial 6 weeks. I went through counterinsurgency school there with the U.S. Army to see how they were training soldiers for counterinsurgency. And it was supposed to be a short trip, a one-time trip. And like so many people who have been there, they fall in love with the place, fall in love with the people. And it sort of became a habit. And so I've been going ever since.
Wow. You fell in love with the place and fell in love with the people. I mean, when I think about going to Afghanistan, I think that sounds really dangerous. But you just said what you said.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is dangerous and has become increasingly so. It's become harder and harder to do research there. But, you know, the landscape is phenomenal. It's gorgeous, mountainous, all kinds of variety, everything from desert to high mountains and everything in between. The population, the people are gracious and welcoming and incredibly hospitable. And I thought I saw an opportunity that I could help. And so, like I say, I've been going every year since.
Wow. Well, again, I want to remind our listeners that you can join us with your comments, questions, and personal experiences with this war in Afghanistan, America's longest war. Today in the Exchange, we're looking at why the U.S. is still there, including the conclusions of a recent Washington Post investigation called the Afghanistan Papers. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. So, Craig, you've kind of hinted at it, but let's go full on. What are the major conclusions of the Afghanistan Papers? I can give you the numbers, 157,000 people killed, mostly Afghans, 2,300 American military members, the money, roughly $1 trillion. So those are the numbers. But what are the big sort of conclusions that you came away with, Craig, after doing all this work?
Yeah, if I could explain a little bit what the Afghanistan Papers are.
That sounds great. Yeah.
These are hundreds of interviews conducted by a federal agency called the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. I know that's a mouthful, but it's a watchdog agency. It's supposed to monitor fraud, waste, and abuse and contract spending in the war zone. But several years ago, they started a side project called Lessons Learned, where starting in 2014, everybody assumed the war was coming to an end. The Obama administration had declared an end to combat operations, and Obama had promised to withdraw all U.S. troops by the end of his presidency. So this agency decided this would be a good time to start interviewing people to look back to discuss what mistakes were made in Afghanistan, what lessons could be learned if, God forbid, the United States ever found itself involved in a similar conflict in the future. This agency has published a number of public reports based on that. But what we found is that they had actually interviewed more than 400 people and had left out all the really interesting criticism that these people involved in the war had said. So the Washington Post had made a number of public records requests for these interviews. Long story short, it took us 3 years to pry these interviews loose from this federal agency, and we were pretty surprised by what they showed. These were people involved at all levels of the war, from commanding generals and ambassadors to people worked in the White House, but also soldiers and aid workers in the field. And the depth and extent of their criticism of how the war was managed and operated was really pretty striking. And let me just give you a few examples that leapt out. These were people, commanding generals saying that they didn't have a strategy, that they fundamentally didn't understand Afghanistan, that people didn't know who the enemy was. We had these interviews with soldiers who said they went over to Afghanistan and they were waiting for people to tell them, who are the bad guys? Who are the bad guys? Let's get in the fight. But they didn't know who the bad guys were. They couldn't tell them apart. And then even at the Pentagon, in memos that Donald Rumsfeld wrote, he used the same language to his staff. He said, I have no visibility into who the bad guys are in Afghanistan. Help. So, if you don't know who the enemy is in the war, that's a pretty basic problem. And that's what these papers showed, was people knew the war wasn't going well. If you have an 18-year war, by definition, it's kind of a mess. So people knew there had been lots of bad news reported from Afghanistan by journalists for many years. But what these papers showed is that people in charge of the war at all levels fundamentally lacked an understanding of what they were doing in Afghanistan, didn't have a strategy that they could agree on or even articulate, and that, in short, things were far worse than the public had been led to believe.
And we'll talk more about that after a short break. The pronouncements by White House officials making it look like it was better than it was, as you said, Craig. And we'll start taking your calls at 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here. The This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, America's longest war. We're reflecting on Afghanistan and what it means to us today. Our guests are Jason Lyle. He teaches in the Departments of Government and Transnational Studies at Dartmouth and directs the Political Violence Field Lab, work that frequently brings him to Afghanistan. Joining us from D.C., Craig Whitlock, investigative reporter for The Washington Post. His recent report, The Afghanistan Papers, is, as he was just telling us, based on previously unpublished interviews with people directly involved in the war, revealing that, despite public declarations of progress, officials believed otherwise. We'd love to hear from you, especially if you're a veteran of this conflict. We did have a veteran of the war scheduled to join us this morning. She had to cancel at the very last minute. So we're really hoping that veterans will call in with their experiences in Afghanistan. You can give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. Or you can email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook or Twitter. And Jason, I want to go back to you, just based on what Craig said just before the break, that these interviews that the Post had to work 3 years, by the way, to make public, people at the very highest levels weren't really sure what they were doing or who the bad guys were. I just wonder what your thoughts are there.
Yeah, it seems like a shocking indictment of the military as a learning organization. It seems that it's been sort of constantly relearning the lessons, and they never, ever are implemented.
Even though the title of this project was Lessons Learned.
Exactly.
Go ahead, Jason.
And so in some senses, lessons are being learned. They're just never being implemented. It's continually a year after year of this trying new things or trying different things that have already been done in the past, and there's no actual collective learning. But I don't want to necessarily cast aspersions on the military effort alone. So the military does what the civilians tell it to do.
Right.
And if the civilians don't have a clear vision of what victory looks like or the path to it, U.S. military is incredibly professional. It will do its best to try and get to the goal that the civilians are setting up. But if the civilians themselves are unclear about how we're getting there, you know, the military is going to keep digging that hole. And so in some ways, if the military is controlled by the civilians, this is on civilians as much as the military, and it is across the board learning failure at all levels of government, not just the military.
Why do you think, Jason, that three administrations now, and as Craig has reported, and academics like you and other journalists have reported, there's plenty of evidence that this is not working out. Why do you think, Jason, that someone, President Obama, President Trump, maybe even President Bush in his, you know, towards the end of his administration, just said, look, sorry, this is not working out, we're done?
So I think there's a couple of reasons for why we haven't seen a decisive just withdrawal. One is no politician, and particularly no president, wants to be on hook if an attack ever comes from Afghanistan and you're the one who withdrew the forces. So there's always this phantom menace out there of an al-Qaeda attack from some distant part of Afghanistan, and you're politically responsible for allowing that to happen. The other thing I would say, though, is that politicians haven't faced a lot of public pressure to end the war. The American public has been very quiet. There's been no protests. There's been no mass movements against the war. You know, it's an all-professional military. There is no draft, so there's no mechanism for people expressing displeasure with the war. And frankly, the war has been financed almost solely by deficit. It hasn't been through taxes. So the American, average American isn't facing a pocketbook hit. They don't know, most Americans don't know, someone who serves. Now, American military service is concentrated in several families, and it's geographically concentrated as well. So the cost being borne by the war is on a small proportion of the overall American public. There just isn't popular pressure for the politicians to end it. And then from their point of view, if they're the ones that end it, and even if there's a small chance that an attack comes from Afghanistan, maybe it's better to keep the war at a low simmer, keep a certain amount of troops there, a certain amount of money. It's not large in the grand scheme of things. And we'll just try and tamp down that threat.
Well, and there's the other side of it, you know, that I was thinking about while you were talking. If you're focusing on Afghanistan, maybe there's threats brewing elsewhere that you're not paying attention to. So there is that.
Absolutely. There's an enormous opportunity cost for what the United States is doing right now in staying in Afghanistan. And in some ways, it may be actually generating more of a threat by staying than it would if it actually withdrew.
Wow.
And so, again, this is a problem that's going to need a resolution. It is slowly making its way to one now. But no one has yet taken the hard political decision to own the costs of it if something happens.
Well, a little bit later, I do want to ask both of you about the Trump administration's talks with the Taliban and what you think about that. But, Craig, I'm really interested in what Jason says. You know, we're pointing fingers at politicians and saying, why didn't they admit that it wasn't going well? Why didn't they get out? And I'm talking about Bush, Obama, and Trump. But what about the public? Jason makes a good point. The public hasn't exactly been in the streets saying, you know, let's end this.
Well, Jason's right, I think, in all of his assessments of why the war has taken so long and the political aspects of that. But one other reason is I think the public isn't aware of what's going on in Afghanistan. And part of that is the fault of or responsibility of the Defense Department and the White House. The war itself in Afghanistan is actually has been very intense. The United States last year dropped more bombs, more ordnance in the air war in Afghanistan than at any point in the last 18 years.
Wow.
So right now, I mean, most people never hear about this, but it's taken an enormous toll on civilians in Afghanistan as well as the opposition fighters. We have somewhere around 12,000 to 13,000 troops in Afghanistan, but we don't know how many because a couple of years ago, the Pentagon stopped making that figure public. It said, we're not going to tell you anymore exactly how many troops we have in Afghanistan because we don't want the enemy to know. But this was completely at odds with decades of thinking. Whenever the United States was involved in some sort of war, the idea was the public had a right to know how many forces were overseas or involved in the conflict. So nowadays, the Pentagon won't say how many troops we have there. Most of the war is taking place in the air. So there's a real serious hardcore war going on, but most Americans have no idea about it, partly because, as Jason said, there's a very small percentage of the population that's directly affected with family or friends involved in the war. But it's also because the Trump administration has made a calculated decision not to publicize what's going on there.
Wow. So we don't really have the data to know what's going on there. That's what you're saying, Craig.
Well, that's right. And a lot of the conflict takes place from the skies or in the countryside. So it's hard for journalists to get in there and see where the fighting takes place. A lot of it's done by Afghan forces in the lead, but there's a lot of U.S. special operation forces, CIA paramilitary forces involved in the war and counterterrorism operation. But it's very difficult for independent journalists to get an up-close glimpse of what's going on there. We don't have journalists embedding with U.S. troops or advisors very much anymore because, again, the military kind of discourages that. And so the public really doesn't get much of a picture of the accurate day-to-day military operations going on in Afghanistan.
How do, Jason, the military service members that you spoke with, that you worked with on your many trips to Afghanistan, how do they feel about the work that they are doing there?
So it's mixed, I would say. I think there's pride in service. I think there's pride in doing a good job, and they're going to do the mission as best they can fulfill it. I think,
as you said earlier, they are carrying out a mission.
They are carrying out a mission, and they're very professional. But if you get them in quiet moments or you get them alone, they will express enormous frustration with the war, in particular because many of these people are not on their first tour or their second tour or their third tour. They've been to Afghanistan 3, 4, 5 times now, and special forces even higher. So they know the country well. They know what progress looks like. They know what progress doesn't look like. And so I think there's a mixture of just quiet professionalism and abject frustration with the war and where we're at right now.
And we tried our hardest, speaking of data, to get numbers, exact numbers, on how many New Hampshire veterans have served in Afghanistan. New Hampshire, as you both know, has a higher percentage than many states of veterans in our population. The best estimate we could get was between 4,000 and 5,000, which seems like a pretty big spread there. But New Hampshire has lost service members in Afghanistan, including just 3 weeks ago, Captain Ryan Faniff of Hudson. Very sad. His plane crashed in Afghanistan. In 2014, New Hampshire former Army Staff Sergeant Ryan Pitts was awarded the Medal of Honor by President Obama. Pitts and his fellow paratroopers were assaulted by hundreds of Taliban fighters at their outpost. 9 Americans died. Pitts, badly wounded, kept fighting, and his commanding officer said he saved lives and turned what has become known as the Battle of Wannat. I just want to play a little from Ryan Pitts speaking at the White House in 2014 because it shows what you said, Jason, you know, pride in service no matter what the mission.
I stand here in awe of the men I served with. Many of them are here today. It was the honor of my life to answer the call and serve our country alongside the men of Chosen Company, the ROC, and all the service members. There were many factors that brought us together and motivated us to fight. For me, it was my love for our country and dedication to my brothers. In my combat experience, the latter is the one guiding principle that carries us through battle. It was the men to our left and right that compelled us to fight with everything we had. There was an absolute duty to be your brother's keeper, a sentiment that I think we all shared. I have seen so much valor displayed by my brothers that I cannot even begin to scratch the surface in the short time I have today. Rather, I will spend a lifetime telling their stories to honor their heroic deeds. This is a responsibility that accompanies the award, a responsibility that has been easier to accept knowing that the award belongs to every man I fought alongside. While the Medal of Honor is awarded to an individual, it has felt like anything but an individual achievement. It is ours, not mine. I will wear it for everyone there that day, especially those we couldn't bring home. The medal represents our sacrifices and those of every service member, and it will forever serve as a memorial to the fallen. I will never view myself as a recipient, but always as a caretaker. The word hero often accompanies the award. I don't care for the term, I never have. It is a distinction I have always felt was reserved for those that make the ultimate sacrifice. However, I am humbled and honored to look at my brothers and see men I consider my personal heroes, men I look up to. To every man who fought that day, every man who came to our aid, every leader and peer I ever had, it has been the honor of my life to serve and fight alongside you and all the brothers we lost.
Again, that's New Hampshire former Army Staff Sergeant Ryan Pitts speaking in 2014 when President Obama gave him the Medal of Honor. Very moving to hear him say, "This honor is ours, not mine." And Craig, I'd like to ask you too, how have veterans of the Afghanistan War responded to your work, the Afghanistan Papers?
I think there's been a lot of frustration and a lot of pain. We've spoken with a number of veterans who responded to our series. And you have to remember, Afghanistan was perceived as a much different war than the war in Iraq. When people served in Afghanistan, they saw this as, how do I put this, more of a just war, an easier war to explain why we were in Afghanistan. It was to defend the United States after the 9/11 attacks. The fight was supposed to be against Al-Qaeda. So people did carry out their mission with valor and bravery and worked very hard. And people who served in the war tried very hard to help build up the Afghan government, Afghan society, the Afghan economy. They tried to help this devastated country put the pieces back together. But when many of them read the interviews from the Afghanistan Papers, when they heard their former commanders and diplomats and White House officials admit that the strategy they had was flawed, that people weren't even sure who the enemy was or what the objectives were, there's a lot of frustration, a lot of pain, even a lot of anger, because I think many of them sensed that things weren't right when they were there, that maybe the mission didn't make sense. But of course, their job as a soldier or troops from other services, it wasn't their job to question the mission, it was to carry out the mission. And they did that, they did their job. But all along, many of them had harbored doubts about the purpose and what was going on at higher levels. So when they read the Afghanistan Papers, I think it reinforced a lot of their doubts, and that led to a lot of anger and frustration.
Very interesting. Again, I want to remind you, especially if you have experience with the Afghanistan War, serving as a member of the military or in some other capacity, we'd love to hear from you. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Jason, I remember a key point during the war that I'm pretty sure you remember too, and that's when President Obama said we're going to have a civilian surge. We're going to bring in all these State Department workers and people building schools and helping with farms and, you know, all this. And this is going to turn the tide with this war. And then, you know, American military can get out.
I remember it well. I was part of the civilian surge.
I'm thinking you were,
At a very low level. But yes, that was the idea that you couldn't just win through military means. you needed to have a civilian effort alongside it that would do exactly that. It would help improve the economy, help improve governance, bring in, you know, agricultural experts to help the economy grow, and that you would essentially help legitimize the Afghan government by getting that economy started again. So you could not just sort of push people away from the Taliban, but actually attract them into the government, show that the government cared, that it could actually, you know, provide jobs and things like that. But it was a very short surge. It didn't last very long.
What happened?
Well, it didn't get staffed up. There was probably about half to three quarters of the number of people who were supposed to surge actually went. And there was a timeline. It was about an 18-month window to show effects, and then Obama was going to begin the withdrawal and begin to pull down some of the soldiers. So there was a very tight mandate. And then I think one of the stories that Craig really hits home in the Afghan papers is that the civilian side and the military side never really had a coordinated strategy. So you would have the civilian surge going out into villages trying to improve the economy. At the same time, and you know, rendering aid and things like that, but at the same time, you would have airstrikes going on in these villages in the same place. Talk about a conflicted message to be sending to people in these particular locations. And so there was an aid component and tremendous amount of money spent. There was a kinetic component, or sort of an airstrike component, and ground operations. And these two things never meshed. And so the civilian surge was small, and it got deluged in sort of mass military operations because the generals at the time had to show results in this 18-month window, or otherwise the resources would be pulled.
So this civilian surge, again, this was President Obama. There wasn't enough coordination on the military side. And maybe not enough time? Is that what you're saying, Jason?
Yeah, not enough time. And also, too, you know, Craig's exactly right. This is not a country where the war began in 2001. It had two decades before to try and come in and provide assistance. We didn't have the first idea of what we were to provide that would work. You know, we had a theory of counterinsurgency that people were joining the Taliban because they were poor, so we should provide jobs. Well, that's a really unproven concept. We put billions of dollars behind it. But it wasn't really why people are joining the Taliban in the first place. So you have this economic tool and tremendous amounts of money flooding in that don't have the right problem. They don't understand the problem. And then so this solution is looking for the problem. And, you know, most people don't join the Taliban because they're poor. So here we are trying to provide jobs, trying to provide aid, trying to get, you know, market stalls back up and running as a way of combating the Taliban through aid. And that wasn't why people were fighting at all.
And academics like you are saying, whoa, 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 before we throw all this money and people at the problem, let's figure out why this is happening.
Right.
And then we can do it in a smarter, more strategic way. But the politicians were saying, no, we're under pressure. Just go in and fix it.
Under pressure. And we thought, you know, the politicians and a lot of the big aid agencies, frankly, thought they had the right solution. It was this job-centered thing. And, you know, you just can't pour this much money into this kind of a country this quickly without experiencing massive corruption and massive amounts of graft and fraud.
All right. We will talk more about the corruption. That was a huge deal. And the money spent, where it went, whether any of it was well spent. I also want to ask both of you about the U.S. Taliban talks that are going on right now, what those are about, what the prospects might be. And we'll keep hearing from you. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org.
From the seacoast to the Upper Valley, Monadnock to the Great North Woods, NHPR covers the stories that impact your community to help you stay connected to what's happening in every corner of the state. I'm Annie Ropeek, a reporter here at NHPR, and when you give $10 a month as a sustainer, you'll help support a vital resource that is statewide, regional, and deeply New Hampshire. Give today at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow in The Exchange, time to catch up on all the state news you might have missed on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup with Peter Biello. That's Friday morning, live at 9. This hour, the war in Afghanistan and why the U.S. is still there. more than 18 years after the conflict began. Send us an email. Tell us what you think and your own experiences if you served in Afghanistan. Exchange at nhpr.org or call 1-800-892-6477. And Craig, I did want to turn to you, too, on the point that Jason was making before the break. Lots of money in Afghanistan to, quote, win the hearts and minds of the people. How well did that go? What did you learn from doing your work with the Afghanistan Papers, Craig?
Well, to be blunt, it was a complete disaster in terms of trying to how much money we spent in Afghanistan and what we have to show for it. Just to put it in perspective, the United States since 2001 has spent over $130 billion just on reconstruction in Afghanistan. So that's not military operations, which is far more money. This is just money sent to Afghanistan to try and build the country back up. That's more money adjusted for inflation than the United States spent after World War II in Europe for the Marshall Plan. So this is the biggest nation-building project ever that the United States has undertaken anywhere in the world, you know, more than in after World War II in Japan or Europe or Korea or anywhere. And yet the country, while the economy has recovered a fair bit, you know, we don't have much to show for all that what we spent over there. And the Afghanistan paper shows interview after interview, people who were involved in spending that money, they kept using a similar word to describe it. They kept saying this was insane. And it was insane how fast they were expected to spend this money, how the projects they selected to spend it on were kind of mindless. There was just this enormous pressure back in Washington to spend. They didn't care on what. There was one aid worker who said there was a U.S. congressman who had come to visit Afghanistan as part of a delegation. And the congressman said, well, how's it going with spending on aid projects? And the aid worker said, congressman, you know, I'm expected to spend $1 million a day in this district on projects. You know, and it, you know, if you were in your district and I told you had to spend $1 million a day, how could you possibly do it? And here I'm doing it in a province with where people live in villages in mud huts and no windows. You know,
wow.
It's just impossible.
Well,
so, as Jason said real quickly, I mean, they were expected to spend an enormous amount of money in a very compressed timeline, and it just didn't add up. And so a lot of money went into people's pockets or just was wasted.
Well, let's go to our listeners again, and our number 1-800-892-6477. Ryan's joining us from Concord. Hi, Ryan. You're on the air. Thanks for calling in today.
Thanks for having me. As a Afghan veteran, I just wanted to talk about my experience over there. Three tours with the 10th Mountain Division, and what I saw over there was a people struggling, and we were there to help. I'm not here to talk about how money's spent or the mission. I'm talking about the men we lost, and just the mission of trying to guide a people to succeed. And that's kind of what I got out of it on my three tours. And just I've been through one of the hardest things about being in deployment. One of my duties over there was fallen soldier ceremonies, ramp ceremonies. And it's hard to put heroes and bring them home.
Right.
My belief is the people belong, or we deserve, the Afghan people deserve a prosperous country like we have, and that's why we're there to help them.
Yeah, so you felt like you were trying to make a difference, Ryan. Three tours. Wow. What did you do? What was your main mission while you were there, your job, so to speak?
My job, I was a logistics coordinator, and I was attached to the 10th Mountain Division as an infantry platoon, and we were on the border of Pakistan, and we were right on the border, and we were actually stationed where Pat Tillman died. So we were right kind of in the thick of things.
Former football player.
There, and just with really amazing men and women I served with. And it's just a community where we were really, really trying to help them, and they didn't really get to see any support from their government, and we were there to show them there is hope. And hope, you can't put a price on hope.
You know, Ryan, it's really great to hear from you. I want to ask you one thing that one of our guests brought up at the beginning of the show, that a lot of Americans have just forgotten about this war. They don't think about it. even though people like you were working there hard every day in incredibly dangerous conditions. And I wonder if you agree with that, that most people, you know, your average person just isn't really thinking about the commitment that we still have there.
I can kind of agree with that, but even the first tour where I was at, when we would go on mid-tour to Iraq, and we were seeing quite a bit of action during that time, because we got extended on that first tour 4 more months because things were really rough, and the people needed us, and our country needed us to step up, and we did it. And even in Iraq, we'd go through these airports going home, and people would be like, well, at least you're in Iraq, and we're like, we're seeing firefights too. We're on the border, and it's kind of the West out there, and we're just trying to help the people. And now I get it. We're all focused on many different things, and it's just the way society is, and I get it. If someone hasn't served, we all are focused on different things, and we kind of can lose it, but all of us should take a step back and just think of the great things we have here. And just that would be the biggest thing, is just take a step back of your own personal stuff, what's going on, and just there's a bigger things out there than looking on your iPhone and going on Amazon.
Yeah. Ryan, I am so glad you called. Thank you very much. And thank you for your service.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm glad he called. And as I said earlier, we did have a veteran who was scheduled to join us, and at the last minute she couldn't. But she also said, Jason, that she feels forgotten. She feels like Afghanistan has just disappeared. Everybody's focused on impeachment or, you know, the latest tweet from the White House or the presidential primary. And, you know, certainly some of those stories may be important, but she told us she really just feels ignored by the public.
Yeah, and I think this is right. And I think partly this is deliberate. Craig mentioned that, you know, there's been very few briefings on Afghanistan. There isn't information control. I remember when I began looking at the effects of airstrikes in Afghanistan, the Air Force used to publish daily records of where it bombed and what it hit. And we could actually take that from the web and begin to build data. Now, you're lucky if you get a summary at the end of the year saying this is what we did. And so it is hard for people to stay engaged, even if they weren't sort of in this firestorm of daily stories from the Trump administration and things like that. It's just the war, you know, it just doesn't affect many people back here. And it's just there's very few soldiers there now. There's 12,000, 13,000. You're not being asked to pay for it. So, again, when you have little information, you know, there's a lot of distractions out there. The war is happening in a very far-off place. It doesn't feel real or tangible. There isn't an imminent security threat. It just falls into the back pages of the newspapers, I think.
Well, and that's why it was so important that you published these Afghanistan papers, Craig, when you did last December, I think, right, when these came out. What's been the reaction, or what was the reaction, in Congress or among military leaders when these came out? Again, showing that for a long, long time, there was, I don't know what to call it, mismanagement at the very top, Craig? What would you call it, and what's been the reaction in Congress to these Afghanistan papers?
Well, we were pleased that when we published in the middle of impeachment, actually, when there were impeachment hearings going on in the House, we published this, and it actually struck a real chord with readers. We had a pretty overwhelming response. People, I think, had suspected that the government wasn't leveling with them, wasn't telling them the truth about what was going on in Afghanistan. And so when they read the series, it confirmed for them a lot of their fears and suspicions, and people were pretty angry. Congress has had several hearings on the Afghanistan papers, had a lot of testimony from people who were involved in the war. That said, Congress is also largely responsible for what's gone on over there, or what hasn't gone on over there. Congress, you know, under our system of government, appropriates money for the war. It's supposed to hold the executive branch accountable, hold hearings, but they, until recently, they've been very quiet and haven't done very much with Afghanistan, haven't had hearings, haven't demanded answers of the Trump administration. They've kind of been sitting on their hands. So, you know, at all levels of government, there's a lot of culpability for this aimless war. And I think, you know, very few of them want to hold themselves accountable for it.
We got an email from Dave Kenny, who is chair of the New Hampshire State Veterans Advisory Committee. And thank you for writing in. He says the emergent peace deal is not a slam dunk. wondered about Mr. Lyle's opinion on the issue with newly elected President Ghani's presidency being contested by his opposition, Abdullah Abdullah, threatening to form his own government. Dave says with instability in their government at the same time as negotiations with the Taliban, what are the prospects this peace deal will come to fruition and be lasting? And Dave, thank you very much for writing in. And this gets to something, Jason, we talked about a little bit earlier, but we've heard for the last week or so that there are talks between the U.S. and the Taliban. So what is the purpose of those talks? What's the hope?
So the hope is that we are slowly moving towards a lasting peace agreement that will have the U.S. withdraw. Right now, what's been put in place is a 7-day reduction in violence. It's not a ceasefire. It's some more of an abstract, nebulous kind of concept that both sides commit to reducing down violence. That hasn't been declared yet, but should potentially be next week, we think, is when the timing is going to begin. If both sides make it to the end of 7 days with a reduction in violence, then the Taliban will begin negotiating with the Afghan government directly. The United States will also at that point begin a drawdown of 5,000 soldiers. It's about 12,000, so it will begin to pull out some of its soldiers. And then the Afghan-Taliban negotiations will begin over big questions like what does the government look like, women's education, all these kinds of questions. So we have to get through this 7-day period, which hasn't been declared yet. And as the email is exactly right, now we have a constitutional crisis in Kabul as well. Ashraf Ghani is seen as illegitimate by his main electoral rival, Abdullah Abdullah. So they are each contesting the elections. Ashraf Ghani believes he won. Abdullah Abdullah believes he won. They both want to have negotiations with the Taliban. They both want to build their own inclusive government. Neither wants to include the other in that government. And so we kind of have a slow unwinding of the Afghan government now.
Oh, what a shame. I mean, terrible timing. Here you have the U.S. and the Taliban finally saying, okay, let's make this better. And when we can work through this reduction in violence, we can include the Afghan government. And then on the Afghan government side, people are saying, I'm in charge. No, I'm in charge.
Absolutely. And this is probably the best opportunity for peace that the United States has seen in the last decade or so. And it's probably the best opportunity it's going to have to get a peace that it likes. The United States has dwindling leverage in this situation. And it may be now that Ashraf Ghani and Abdullah Abdullah are going to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory here and fall apart at the negotiating table. I hope that's not the case. I'm trying to be optimistic. At most, though, this is going to be a multi-year process. So the United States will not be out for at least 3 to 4 years, even with this current timeline. So it's going to be a slow-moving kind of series of negotiations.
Craig, what do you think? Can you jump in on this? It's terrible timing.
It is terrible timing, and Jason gives a very accurate representation of what's going on. But if you just step back and think about how we got to this point, here we are. We're negotiating with the Taliban. We've kind of forgotten 18 years ago, you know, how we got here. You know, people have forgotten, why are we fighting the Taliban? You know, the initial goal was to topple them from power because they had harbored al-Qaeda. Well, al-Qaeda is nowhere to be found. We're talking with the Taliban. That's been kind of controversial, but trying to get some sort of, you know, reduction in violence, get them to agree to a U.S. troop withdrawal to negotiate with the Afghans. We've been propping up this Afghan government for years and years, but they have an enormous corruption and credibility problem, not just internationally, but with their own people. You know, Jason mentioned how President Ghani has had a split with Abdullah Abdullah, another leader in his government, that they don't recognize the results of this election. The election took place over 5 months ago. They just came out with the final results this week. So you think about it. If you have an election in a country, it takes 5 months to figure out the results. You know there's problems. And this is a government that we helped create, we helped set up. It hasn't gone very well. We're trying to patch it together and find a way out. But it's going to be very, very difficult to get all these parties at a table and come to some kind of consensus.
Go ahead, Jason.
I said Craig's exactly right on this. The election was a shambles in many ways. So about 18% of the electorate, the eligible electorate, voted. Ashraf Ghani says he has about 9% of that. So he has a very, very razor-thin mandate. Most people didn't turn out. And I think this is one of the the worst things about this election is that most people seem to have either become disabused of the notion of democracy, or they're too tired to come out and vote, or exhausted with it. This is the crowning achievement, if there's one, in Afghanistan. It's a democratic system. And if you've got more than 80% of the electorate staying home, either due to security fears or because they don't believe in the system anymore, there's deep, deep problems in the Afghan political system.
Last question for you, Craig. What was the biggest surprise for you working on the Afghanistan papers, even as a reporter who's covered national security and the Pentagon for a long time? What did you not expect going into this, Craig?
Just the bluntness and candidness of some of the comments people made in the interviews. People are involved in the war, not just involved in the war, but the generals and the diplomats saying literally things like, we didn't know what we were doing. We lacked a fundamental understanding of Afghanistan. You know, we didn't have a strategy that made any sense. These are the people in charge of the war saying this sort of thing. And just the rawness and the bluntness of it was something I never expected to see.
Well, and Jason, you are heading back to Afghanistan soon?
Should be in the fall, yes.
In the fall. What are you going to be doing there?
So we're looking at the effects of humanitarian aid after suicide bombings and civilian casualties have been inflicted. There's a USAID program that looks at, tries to provide assistance in the aftermath of these, you know, airstrikes gone wrong or suicide bombings, and we're looking to see whether that works or not.
Wow. So if there is a mistake made by our military,
yes,
and civilians are killed, you have to go in there and figure out how to make people feel okay? I mean,
yes, yeah, so they provide a standard package to people after these kinds of events, and we want to see if it provides people their livelihoods back and their views of the government in the United States after these incidents.
Wow, tough job. All right, and I want to also mention that your new book, Jason, is called Divided Armies, Inequality and Battlefield Performance in Modern War. I want to get that out there. And thank you very much for coming in today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Jason Lyle. He teaches in the Departments of Government and Transnational Studies at Dartmouth and directs the Political Violence Field Lab there. And Craig Whitlock, thank you so much also for taking time out for us. We really appreciate it.
Good to be here. Thank you.
That's Craig Whitlock, investigative reporter for The Washington Post. If you want to look at the Afghanistan papers that Craig worked on, you can go to our website. It's nhpr.org/exchange. And you're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.